Everything he knew was the law of the jungle, and then he was sent to Mirwala to be the top cop looking after Mukhtar. He was taken aback by Mukhtar and her commitment to the poor and helpless, and in spite of himself, he came to admire her deeply. "It is a spiritual feeling," he recalled. "I am very glad when I see Mukhtar and Bibi going abroad, when she opens schools or shelters." As Farouk fell under Mukhtar's spell, he became increasingly uncomfortable with the orders from his superiors to spy on her and harass her. When his superiors scolded Farouk for protecting Mukhtar, he told his bosses of her wonderful work. That's when he was abruptly transferred to a distant police post. Farouk continued to denounce the persecution of Mukhtar publicly. So we asked him why he risked his career to stand up for a woman he was supposed to have punished. "I have been a bad cop," he said, "to bad people. Yes, but I was bad. One day I was thinking, in my life, have I ever done anything good? Well, now I have a chance from God to do something good. She is helping people, and I must help Mukhtar and Bibi. I must do something good. That is why, in spite of every danger to my life, to my career, I support Mukhtar and Bibi." Farouk said that his personnel reviews were now highly negative and that his police career was effectively over. He feared that he could be murdered. But through watching Mukhtar, he had found a new purpose in life, protecting and speaking up for impoverished women in the villages. After the Musharraf government collapsed in 2008, a cloud lifted from Mukhtar's operations. The intelligence agencies began to spy on terrorists instead of on Mukhtar. "Pakistani spies no longer tailed us when Mukhtar showed us around the nearby villages. The government stopped harassing her, and the dangers eased just a little, allowing Mukhtar to step up her activities. This uneducated woman from a tiny village had stood up to her country's president and army chief, and after years of enduring unremitting threats and harassment, she had outlasted him. She had taken a sordid tale of victimization and, through her extraordinary courage and vision, become an inspiration to us as well. Chapter 5. The Shame of Honor. If a man takes a wife, and after lying with her, dislikes her and slanders her and gives her a bad name, saying, "I married this woman, but when I approached her, I did not find proof of her virginity," then the girl's father and mother shall display the cloth that the couple slept on before the elders of the town. If, however, the charge is true and no proof of the girl's virginity can be found, she shall be brought to the door of her father's house, and there the men of her town shall stone her to death. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 13 through 21. Of all the things that people do in the name of God, killing a girl because she doesn't bleed on her wedding night is among the most cruel. Yet the hymen, fragile, rarely seen, and pretty pointless, remains an object of worship among many religions and societies around the world, the simulacrum of honor. No matter how much gold may sell for, a hymen is infinitely more valuable. It is frequently worth more than a human life. The cult of virginity has been exceptionally widespread. Not only does the Bible advocate stoning girls to death when they fail to bleed on their wedding sheets, but Solon, the great lawgiver of ancient Athens, prescribed that no Athenian could be sold into slavery save a woman who lost her virginity before marriage. In China, a Neo-Confucian saying from the Song dynasty declares, "For a woman to starve to death is a small matter, but for her to lose her chastity is a calamity." This harsh view has dissipated in most of the world, but survives in the Middle East. And this emphasis on sexual honor is today a major reason for violence against women. Sometimes it takes the form of rape, because, as with Mukhtar, often the simplest way to punish a rival family is to violate the daughter. Sometimes it takes the form of honor killing, in which a family kills one of its own girls because she has behaved immodestly or has fallen in love with a man. Often there is no proof that they have had sex, and autopsies of victims of honor killings frequently reveal the hymen to be intact. The paradox of honor killings is that societies with the most rigid moral codes end up sanctioning behavior that is supremely immoral, murder. Duwa Aswad was a beautiful Kurdish girl living in northern Iraq. She was 17 years old when she fell in love with a Sunni Arab boy. One night, she stayed out with him. Nobody knows if they actually slept together, but her family assumed that they had. When Duwa returned the next morning, she saw the rage in her family and ran to seek shelter in the home of a tribal elder. But religious leaders and her own family members insisted that she must die. So 8 men stormed the elder's house and dragged her out into the street as a large crowd gathered around her. Honor killings are illegal in Iraqi Kurdistan, but security forces were present as Duwa was attacked, and they did not interfere. At least 1,000 men joined in the assault. So many men in the crowd shot video clips with their cell phones that on the web you can find a half dozen versions of what happened next. Duwa was thrown to the ground, and her black skirt was ripped off to humiliate her. Her long, thick hair cascaded around her shoulders. She tried to get up, but the men kicked her around as if she were a soccer ball. Frantic, she tried to fend off the blows, to get up, to cover herself, to find a sympathetic face in the crowd. Then the men gathered rocks and concrete blocks and dropped them on her. Most rolled off, but she began bleeding. Some of the rocks struck her head. It took 30 minutes for Duwa to die. When she was dead and could no longer feel shame, some men in the crowd covered her legs and bottom again. This seemed to be meant as a sanctimonious gesture of righteousness, as if the obscenity were a teenage girl's bare flesh rather than her bleeding corpse. The United Nations Population Fund has estimated that there are 5,000 honor killings a year, almost all in the Muslim world. Pakistan's government uncovered 1,261 honor killings in 2003 alone. But that estimate appears too low, because so many of the executions are disguised as accidents or suicides. Our estimate is that at least 6,000, and probably far more, honor killings take place annually around the world. In any case, that figure doesn't begin to capture the scope of the problem, because it doesn't include what might be called honor rapes, those rapes intended to disgrace the victim or demean her clan. In recent genocides, rape has been used systematically to terrorize certain ethnic groups. Mass rape is as effective as slaughtering people, yet it doesn't leave corpses that lead to human rights prosecutions. And rape tends to undermine the victims' group's tribal structures, because leaders lose authority when they can't protect the women. In short, rape becomes a tool of war in conservative societies precisely because female sexuality is so sacred. Codes of sexual honor in which women are valued based on their chastity ostensibly protect women, but in fact, they create an environment in which women are systematically dishonored. In Darfur, it gradually became clear that the Sudanese-sponsored Janjaweed militias were seeking out and gang-raping women of 3 African tribes, then cutting off their ears or otherwise mutilating them to mark them forever as rape victims. To prevent the outside world from knowing, the Sudanese government punished women who reported rapes or sought medical treatment. When one student, Hawa, was gang-raped and beaten by the Janjaweed outside Kalma camp, her friends carried her to a clinic run by Doctors of the World, an aid group. 2 French nurses immediately began caring for her injuries, but several truckloads of police stormed the clinic, pushed aside the French nurses who tried valiantly to resist, and burst in on Hawa. They dragged her out of the clinic and carried her off to prison, where she was chained to a cot by an arm and a leg. The crime? Fornication. For by seeking treatment, she was acknowledging that she had engaged in sex before marriage, and she did not provide the mandatory 4 adult male Muslim eyewitnesses to prove that it was rape. Sudan also blocked aid groups from bringing into Darfur post-exposure prophylaxis kits, which can greatly reduce the risk that a rape victim will be infected with HIV. Mass rapes have been reported at stunning levels in recent conflicts. Half of the women in Sierra Leone endured sexual violence or the threat of it during the upheavals there, and a United Nations report claims that 90% of girls and women over the age of 3 were sexually abused in parts of Liberia during civil war there. Even in places like Pakistan, where there is no genocide or all-out war, honor rapes arise from an obsession with virginity and from the authorities' indifference to injustices suffered by the poor and uneducated. Shershah Syed, a prominent gynecologist in Karachi, says that he frequently treats young girls from the slums after rapes. And then, unless the girl kills herself, the family has to move away. Otherwise, the perpetrators, who are usually rich and well-connected, will terrorize the family and eliminate them as witnesses. And the police are worse than indifferent. When I treat rape victims, I tell the girls not to go to the police, Dr. Syed added, because if a girl goes to the police will rape her. The world capital of rape is the Eastern Congo. Militias consider it risky to engage in firefights with other gunmen, so instead they assault civilians. They discovered that the most cost-effective way to terrorize civilian populations is to conduct rapes of stunning brutality. Frequently, the Congolese militias rape women with sticks or knives or bayonets, or else they fire their guns into the women's vaginas. In one instance, soldiers raped a 3-year-old girl and then fired their guns into her. When surgeons saw her, there was no tissue left to repair. The little girl's grief-stricken father then committed suicide. All militias here rape women to show their strength and to show your weakness, said Julien Shakupiwa, a rape counselor in Goma, Congo. In other places, there is rape because the soldiers want a woman. Here, it's that, but also a viciousness, a mentality of hatred, and it's women who pay the price. We say women, Julien added quickly, but these victims are not adults. They are girls of 14, even children of 6. In 2008, the United Nations formally declared rape a weapon of war, and Congo came up constantly in the discussions. Major General Patrick Kamar, a former United Nations force commander, spoke of the spread of rape as a war tactic and said something haunting. It has probably become more dangerous to be a woman than a soldier in an armed conflict. One of those Congolese victims is Dina, a 17-year-old from the town of Kindu. She wore a blue shirt and bright multicolored skirt as she told us her story, an orange headscarf fastened demurely over her head. Dina was shy, speaking softly through an interpreter, and she smiled often in nervousness. One of 6 children, Dina grew up working on her parents' farm, growing bananas, cassava, and beans. 2 of her brothers attended school for a bit, but none of the daughters did. It's more important to educate boys, she explained, and she seemed to believe it. All the local residents knew that there were soldiers from the Hutu and Herahamwe militia in the area, so Dina was fearful when she went out to farm the crops. But the alternative was to starve. One day, because of the danger, Dina cut short her work in her bean field and headed back to town well before sunset. As she was walking home, 5 Hutu militia members surrounded her. They had guns and knives and forced her to the ground. One of them was carrying a stick. If you cry out, we will kill you, one of them told Dina. So she kept quiet as one by one the 5 men raped her. Then they held her down as one of them shoved the stick inside her. When Dina didn't come home, her father and friends bravely went out to the fields, and there they found her, half dead in the grass. They covered her and carried her back to her home. There was a health center in Kindu, but Dina's family couldn't afford to take her there to be treated, so she was cared for only at home. She lay paralyzed in her bed, unable to walk. The stick had broken into her bladder and rectum, causing a fistula, or hole, in the tissues. As a result, urine and feces trickled constantly through her vagina and down her legs. These injuries, Rectovaginal and vesicovaginal fistulas are common in Congo because of sexual violence. My people had no tribal conflict with them, Dina said of the soldiers. Their only purpose was to rape me and leave me bleeding and leaking wastes. This culture of brutality spread from militia to militia, from tribe to tribe. In just the Congolese province of South Kivu, the UN estimates that there were 27,000 sexual assaults in 2006. By another UN accounting, three-quarters of the women in some areas had been raped. John Holmes, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, says flatly, "The sexual violence in Congo is the worst in the world." One of the warlords whose troops have been implicated in the rapes is Laurent Nkunda, a tall, genial man who served us dinner in his comfortable mountain lair. He passes himself off as a Pentecostal pastor and piously wore a Rebels for Christ button on his uniform, apparently because he thought it would win him American support. Before he offered us drinks and snacks, he said grace. Nkunda insisted that his troops never rape anybody, adding that the only time one of his soldiers did rape a woman, he executed the soldier. Yet everyone knows that rape is routine. When Nkunda pressed some of the prisoners of war whom his soldiers had seized from rival armed militias, we asked them about rape. "If we see girls, it is our right," said one, Noel Rowaberimba, a 16-year-old who said he had carried a gun for 2 years. "We can violate them." United Nations peacekeepers did little to stop the rapes. Former Ambassador Stephen Lewis of Canada, one of the most eloquent advocates for the world's women, has suggested that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon should make mass rape a priority and pledge to resign if member countries don't support him. We're talking about more than 50% of the world's population, amongst whom are the most uprooted, disinherited, and impoverished of the earth, Lewis said. If you can't stand up for the women of the world, then you shouldn't be Secretary General. Women have suffered grievously in the genocides of Rwanda and Darfur. Men, too. In Rwanda, when the genocide was over, 70% of the country's population was female because so many more men were killed. In Darfur, after interviewing several women who told of having been raped when leaving their camps to get firewood, we asked the obvious question. If women are raped when they get firewood, then why don't they stay in the camp? Why don't men collect the firewood? When men leave the camp, they're shot dead, one of the women explained patiently. When the women leave, they're only raped. In almost every conflict, mortality is disproportionately male. But whereas men are the normal victims of war, women have become a weapon of war, meant to be disfigured or tortured to terrorize the rest of the population. To travel in eastern Congo and talk to villagers is to uncover layers and layers of routinized rape. In a camp for displaced people, we asked to speak to a rape victim, and one was immediately brought over. To ensure her privacy, we took her under a tree away from other people. But after 10 minutes, a long line of women formed nearby. "What are you all doing here?" we asked. "We're all rape victims," explained the woman in front. "We're waiting to tell our stories, too." For Dina, lying incontinent and paralyzed in her home, life seemed to be over. Then neighbors began telling her family about a hospital where doctors could fix injuries like hers. The hospital is called Heal Africa, and it is located in Goma, the biggest city in eastern Congo. The family contacted Heal Africa's representative, and he arranged for a missionary plane to carry Dina to Goma for treatment. Heal Africa covered the expense. Dina was taken from the Goma airstrip by ambulance to the Heal Africa hospital. It was the first time she had ever ridden in a car. Nurses gave her a plastic diaper and put her together with dozens of other women, all of whom were incontinent because of fistulas. This gave Dina the courage to try to stand and walk. The nurses gave her a crutch and helped her hobble about. They fed her and began a course of physical therapy and added her name to a list of women waiting for fistula surgery. When Dina's day came, a doctor successfully sewed up her rectovaginal fistula. Then she underwent more physical therapy as she prepared for a second operation to repair the hole in her bladder. Meanwhile, Dina began to wonder what she would do post-surgery, and she decided to stay for the time being in Goma. "If I return to Kindu," she explained, "I'll just be raped again." Yet after the second surgery, which also succeeded, Dina decided to go back to Kindu after all. She missed her family, and in any case, the war was also reaching into Goma. It seemed to Dina that she might be just as vulnerable if she stayed, so she chose to return to the maelstrom of Kindu. Study abroad, in the Congo. In the cauldron of violence and misogyny that is Eastern Congo, the Heal Africa Hospital where Dina was treated is a sanctuary of dignity. It is a large compound of low white buildings where patients are respected. It's an example of an aid project that makes an extraordinary difference in people's lives, and one of those helping patients like Dina is a young American woman named Harper McConnell. Harper has long, dirty blonde hair and very white skin that seems to redden more than tan under the tropical sun. She dresses casually, and with the exception of African necklaces dangling on her collar, she looks as if she could be on an American university campus. Yet here she is, in war-torn Congo, speaking excellent Swahili and bantering with her new friends who grew up in the Congolese bush. She has taken a path that more young Americans should consider, traveling to the developing world to give back to people who desperately need the assistance. Young people often ask us how they can help address issues like sex trafficking or international poverty. Our first recommendation to them is to get out and see the world. If you can't do that, it's great to raise money or attention at home. But to tackle an issue effectively, you need to understand it. And it's impossible to understand an issue by simply reading about it. You need to see it firsthand, even live in its midst. One of the great failings of the American education system, in our view, is that young people can graduate from university without any understanding of poverty at home or abroad. Study abroad programs tend to consist of herds of students visiting Oxford or Florence or Paris. We believe that universities should make it a requirement that all graduates spend at least some time in the developing world, either by taking a gap year or by studying abroad. If more Americans worked for a summer teaching English at a school like Mukhtar's in Pakistan, or working at a hospital like Heal Africa in Congo, our entire society would have a richer understanding of the world around us, and the rest of the world might also hold a more positive view of Americans. Young people, women especially, often worry about the safety of volunteering abroad. There are, of course, legitimate concerns about disease and violence, but mostly there is the exaggerated fear of the unknown, the mirror image of the nervousness that Africans or Indians feel when they travel to America for their studies. In reality, Americans and Europeans are usually treated hospitably in the developing world and are much less likely to be robbed in an African village than in Paris or Rome. The most dangerous part of living in a poor country is often the driving, since no one wears seatbelts, and red lights, if they exist, tend to be regarded as mere suggestions. American women sometimes do get unwanted attention, particularly if they are blonde, but it's rarely threatening. Once women have settled in at their destination, they usually find it safer than they had imagined. Western women are often exempt from local indignities and harassment, partly because local men find them intimidating. Women volunteers often have more options than men do. For example, in conservative cultures, it may be inappropriate for an American man to teach female students or even talk to women, while an American woman may well be able to teach either boys or girls and to mix with local men and women alike. There are countless opportunities to volunteer at the grassroots. Most of the aid programs we refer to in this book welcome volunteers, as long as they stay for a few months to make the visit worth the trouble. Time spent in Congo and Cambodia might not be as pleasant as in Paris, but it will be life-changing. Harper, who grew up in Michigan and Kansas, was studying political science and English at the University of Minnesota, not sure what she would do afterward. She had studied poverty and development and was feeling restless and pressured with graduation looming. Then, in May of her senior year, she heard that her church was exploring a relationship with a hospital in Congo. The church, Upper Room, in Edina, Minnesota, understood something important. The congregation should not just be writing checks, but also getting actively involved. So Harper talked to her pastor about the Congo arrangement, and by the end of the meeting, Harper had agreed to go live in Goma to oversee the relationship with the Heal Africa Hospital. "We want to educate our congregation about Eastern Congo and give them the chance to come and see life here," she says. "I also provide the church with the reality on the ground to make sure that projects which are dreamed up in offices in the United States actually meet the needs in the field." Harper stays in a nice Western-style house in Goma with the couple who founded the Heal Africa Hospital, a Congolese doctor, Joe Lucy, and his wife, Lynn, from England. Joe and Lynn take up one room in the house, which is always crowded with visitors and guests. And while it provides a sanctuary from the chaos of Congo, the generator still goes off at 10 p.m., and don't count on a hot shower. Then there's the countryside, which often feels as if it's a century or two behind Goma. One day, Harper was bubbling with news. "One of our teams just went to a village that hadn't seen a car since the 1980s. They called it a walking house." Heal Africa is a major hospital. Officially, it has 150 beds, but there are usually 250 patients, and it manages to accommodate them. There are 14 doctors and a total staff of 210, all of whom are Congolese except for Lynn, Harper, and one other person. The hospital manages to have clean sheets, but there are still just two gynecologists in an area with 5 million people. Getting electricity, water, and bandages for the hospital is a nightmare, and corruption is overwhelming. In 2002, a nearby volcano erupted, and when the lava reached the building, the hospital burst into flames. Most of the hospital grounds were covered in 8 feet of lava. But with support from American donors, the hospital was rebuilt as soon as the lava had cooled. For a young single person, living in a place like Goma can be tedious and confining. Harper broke up with her boyfriend of 2 years when she moved to Congo, and although she regularly gets marriage proposals from drivers, there isn't any dating scene. Once she contracted malaria and ended up in her own hospital, but she felt a measure of pride at finally enduring the standard African ailment. As she was lying feverishly in her hospital bed, nourished by an IV drip, she awoke thinking that she saw Ben Affleck looming over her hospital bed. She soon realized it was not a figment of her delirium. Affleck was visiting Congo and had come by to wish her well. There are also compensations for the lack of shopping malls and Netflix movies. Harper has undertaken 2 major projects that make her excited to get out of bed each morning. First, she started a school at the hospital for children awaiting medical treatment. It can take several months before children with orthopedic problems receive care, and they often come from rural areas with no decent schools. So Harper found teachers and put together a classroom. The children can now go to school 6 days a week. At the age of 23, Harper became the principal of her own school. Second, Harper started a skills training program for women awaiting surgery. Many of the patients, like Dina, spend months at the hospital, and they can now use the time to learn to sew, read, weave baskets, make soap, and bake bread. Typically, a woman chooses one of the skills and then works with a trainer until she is confident she can make a living at it. When the woman leaves, Heal Africa gives her the raw materials she needs, even a pedal sewing machine, if she has learned tailoring, so that she can generate income for her family afterward. Those who have trouble absorbing vocational skills are at least given a big block of salt so that they can break it up and sell little bags of salt in the market to survive. The ability to earn a living transforms the women's lives. "The women are so excited about Harper's program," said Dada Biamungu, whom Harper hired to teach sewing. As we talked, a raucous group of women surrounded Harper, teasing her and thanking her in Swahili, all at the same time, and she was laughing and retorted in rapid-fire Swahili. Dada translated what the women were saying. "They say that they will lift Harper up and make her their queen." "If you were to come to dinner at our home, you would see lovely woven reed placemats made by women at Heal Africa. Harper has set up a little shop at the hospital to sell goods like these that the women are making, and she's trying to sell them on the internet and in American department stores as well. If you're an American university student, there's something else that Harper did that may be more relevant. She is setting up a study abroad program for Americans who want to spend a month at ULPGL, a university in Goma. The Americans will take courses with Congolese students, spend time in the classroom and the field, and write research papers together in small groups. Harper also tries to encourage donors in the United States. The hospital has an annual budget of $1.4 million, more than one-third of which is contributed by individual Americans. More information is at www.healafrica.org. Only 2% of those donations go to overhead and administrative expenses. The rest is plowed into the hospital. The hospital even accepts gifts of airline miles to fly staff back and forth, and it eagerly welcomes volunteers and visitors. "I'd rather have someone come here and see what's going on than write a check for $1,000 or $2,000, because that visit is going to change their life," Harper says. "I have the privilege of hearing from church members and other visitors about how their time at Heal Africa has turned their worldview upside down and changed their lifestyle at home." As Harper jabbers away in Swahili with her African friends, it's clear that she is getting as well as giving. She agrees. "There are times when all I want is a fast internet connection, a latte, and a highway to drive on. Yet the greetings I receive in the morning from my coworkers are enough to keep me here. I have the blessing of carrying a purse sewn by a woman waiting for fistula surgery at the hospital, and watching how these new skills have changed her whole composure and confidence, of celebrating with my Congolese friend who was accepted for a job right after he graduated from university, and of seeing children in school who previously never had the chance, of rejoicing with a family over their improved harvest, of dancing with my coworkers over a grant awarded for a program. The main factor that separates me from my friends here is the opportunities I was given as a first world citizen. And I believe it is my responsibility to work so that these opportunities are available to all." Chapter 6. Maternal Mortality. One Woman a Minute. Preparation for death is that most reasonable and seasonable thing to which you must now apply yourself. Cotton Mather, in a sermon advising pregnant women. No one reading this book, we hope, can fathom the sadistic cruelty of those soldiers who used a pointed stick to tear apart Dina's insides. But there is also a milder, more diffuse cruelty of indifference, and it is global indifference that leaves some 3 million women and girls incontinent just like Dina. Fistulas like hers are common in the developing world, but outside of Congo are overwhelmingly caused not by rape, but by obstructed labor and lack of medical care during childbirth. Most of the time, such women don't get any surgical help to repair their fistulas because maternal health and childbirth injuries are rarely a priority. For every Dina, there are hundreds like Mehabuba Muhammad, a tall woman who grew up in western Ethiopia. Mehabuba has light chocolate skin and frizzy hair that she ties back. Today, she tells her story easily, for the most part, occasionally punctuated with self-mocking laughter. but there are moments when the old pain shines through in her eyes. Mehabuba was raised in a village near the town of Jimma, and her parents divorced when she was a child. As a result, she was handed over to her father's sister, who didn't educate her and generally treated her as a servant. So Mehabuba and her sister ran off together to town and worked as maids in exchange for room and board. "Then a neighbor told me he could find better work for me," Mehabuba recalled. "He sold me for 80 birr, $10. He got the money. I didn't. I thought I was going to work for the man who bought me, in his house. But then he raped me and beat me. He said he had bought me for 80 birr and wouldn't let me go. I was about 13. The man, Jayad, was about 60 years old and had purchased Mehabuba to be his second wife. In rural Ethiopia, girls are still sometimes sold to do manual labor or to be second or third wives, although it is becoming less common. Mehabuba hoped for consolation from the first wife, but instead the woman whipped Mehabuba with savage relish. "She used to beat me when he wasn't around, so I think she was jealous," Mehabuba remembered angrily, and she paused for a moment as the old bitterness caught up with her. The couple wouldn't let Mehabuba out of the house for fear she might run away. Indeed, she tried several times, but each time she was caught and thrashed with sticks and fists until she was black, blue, and bloody. Soon, Mehabuba was pregnant, and as she approached her due date, Jayad relaxed his guard over her. When she was 7 months pregnant, she finally succeeded in running away. "I thought if I stayed, I might be beaten to death along with my child," Mehabuba said. "I fled to the town, but the people there said they would take me right back to Jayad. So then I ran away again, back to my native village. But my immediate family was no longer there, and nobody else wanted to help me because I was pregnant and somebody's wife. So I went to drown myself in the river, but an uncle found me and took me back. He told me to stay in a little hut by his house." Mehabuba couldn't afford a midwife, so she tried to have the baby by herself. Unfortunately, her pelvis hadn't yet grown large enough to accommodate the baby's head, a common occurrence with young teenagers. She ended up in obstructed labor, with the baby stuck inside her birth passage. After 7 days, Mehabuba fell unconscious, and at that point, someone summoned a birth attendant. By then, the baby had been wedged there for so long that the tissues between the baby's head and Mehabuba's pelvis had lost circulation and rotted away. When Mehabuba recovered consciousness, she found that the baby was dead and that she had no control over her bladder or bowels. She also couldn't walk or even stand, a consequence of nerve damage that is a frequent byproduct of fistula. "People said it was a curse," Mehabuba recalled. "They said, if you're cursed, you shouldn't stay here. You should leave." Mehabuba's uncle wanted to help the girl, but his wife feared that helping someone cursed by God would be sacrilegious. She urged her husband to take Mehabuba outside the village and leave the girl to be eaten by wild animals. He was torn. He gave Mehabuba food and water, but he also allowed the villagers to move her to a hut at the edge of the village. "Then they took the door off," she added matter-of-factly, "so that the hyenas would get me. Sure enough, after darkness fell, the hyenas came." Mehabuba couldn't move her legs, but she held a stick in her hand and waved it frantically at the hyenas, shouting at them. All night long, the hyenas circled her. All night long, Mehabuba fended them off. She was 14 years old. When morning light came, Mehabuba realized that her only hope was to get out of the village to find help, and she was galvanized by a fierce determination to live. She had heard of a Western missionary in a nearby village, so she began to crawl in that direction, pulling her body with her arms. She was half dead when she arrived a day later at the doorstep of the missionary. Aghast, he rushed her inside, nursed her, and saved her life. On his next trip to Addis Ababa, He took Mehabooba with him to a compound of one-story white buildings on the edge of the city, the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital. There, Mehabooba found scores of other girls and women also suffering from fistulas. On arrival, she was examined, bathed, given new clothes, and shown how to wash herself. Fistula patients often suffer wounds on their legs from the acid in their urine eating away at the skin, but frequent washings can eliminate these sores. The girls in the hospital walk around in flip-flops, chattering with one another and steadily dripping urine. Hospital staff joke that it is Puddle City. But the floors are mopped several times an hour, and the girls are too busy socializing with one another to be embarrassed. The hospital is run by Catherine Hamlin, a gynecologist who is truly a saint. She has devoted most of her life to poor women in Ethiopia, undergoing danger and hardship while transforming the lives of countless young women like Mehabooba. Tall, lean, and white-haired, Catherine is athletic, welcoming, and wonderfully gentle, except when people suggest she is a saint. "I love this work," she said in exasperation the first time we met. "I'm not here because I'm a saint or doing anything noble. I enjoy my life tremendously. I'm here because I feel God wants me to be here. I feel I'm doing some good and helping these women. It's very satisfying work." Catherine and her late husband, Reg Hamlin, moved from their native Australia to Ethiopia in 1959 to work as OBGYNs. In Australia, they had never seen a single case of fistula. In Ethiopia, they encountered fistulas constantly. "These are the women most to be pitied in the world," Catherine says firmly. "They're alone in the world, ashamed of their injuries. For lepers or AIDS victims, there are organizations that help, but nobody knows about these women or helps them." Fistulas used to be common in the West, and there was once a fistula hospital in Manhattan, where the Waldorf Astoria Hotel is now. But then improved medical care all but eliminated the problem. Now, almost no woman in the rich world spends 4 days in obstructed labor. Long before then, doctors give her a C-section. In 1975, Catherine and Reg founded the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital, and it remains a lovely hillside compound of white buildings and verdant gardens. Catherine presides over the hospital, living in a cozy house in the center of the compound, and she plans to be buried in Addis Ababa alongside her husband. Catherine has presided over more than 25,000 fistula surgeries and has trained countless doctors in the specialty. She is an exceptionally skilled surgeon, but because some patients don't have enough tissue left to repair, they are given colostomies so that feces leave the body through a hole made in the abdomen and are stored in a pouch that must be regularly disposed of. Patients with colostomies require ongoing care and live in a village near the hospital. Mehabooba is one of those who couldn't be fully repaired. Physical therapy got her walking again, but she had to settle for a colostomy. Still, when she had recovered her mobility, Catherine put her to work in the hospital. At first, Mehabooba simply changed linens or helped patients wash. But gradually, the doctors realized that she was smart and eager to do more, and they gave her more responsibilities. She learned to read and write, and she blossomed. She found a purpose in life. Today, if you were to visit the hospital, you might well see Mehabooba walking around in her nurse's uniform. She has been promoted to the position of senior nurse's aide. It costs about $300 to repair a fistula, and about 90% of them are repairable. But the vast majority of women who suffer fistulas are impoverished peasants who are never taken to a doctor and never receive medical assistance. L. Lewis Wall, a professor of obstetrics at the Washington University School of Medicine, who has campaigned tirelessly for a fistula hospital in West Africa, estimates that 30,000 to 130,000 new cases of fistula develop each year in Africa alone. Instead of receiving treatment, these young women, often just girls of 15 or 16, typically find their lives effectively over They are divorced from their husbands, and because they emit a terrible odor from their wastes, are often forced to live in a hut by themselves on the edge of the village, as Mehabuba was. Eventually, they starve to death or die of an infection that progresses along the birth canal. The fistula patient is the modern-day leper, notes Ruth Kennedy, a British nurse midwife who worked with Catherine at the Fistula Hospital. She's helpless, she's voiceless. The reason these women are pariahs is because they are women. If this happened to men, we would have foundations and supplies coming in from all over the world. Oprah Winfrey interviewed Catherine and was so taken with her that she later visited the Fistula Hospital and donated a new wing for it. Yet maternal health generally gets minimal attention because those who die or suffer injuries overwhelmingly start with three strikes against them. They are female, they are poor, and they are rural. Women are marginalized in the developing world, says Catherine. They are an expendable commodity. Granted, healthcare is deficient in poor countries, even for men. 11% of the world's inhabitants live in sub-Saharan Africa, and they suffer 24% of the world's disease burden, which is addressed with less than 1% of the world's healthcare spending. But maternal care is particularly neglected, never receiving adequate funding. For the 2009 fiscal year, President George W. Bush actually proposed an 18% cut in U.S. aid spending for maternal and child care to just $370 million, or about $1.20 per American per year. Conservatives battle forced abortions in China, and liberals fight passionately for abortion rights in foreign lands. But meeting the challenge of women dying in childbirth has never had much of a constituency. We in the news media can count inattention to the issue as another of our failures. The equivalent of 5 jumbo jets worth of women die in labor each day, but the issue is almost never covered. The remedy? America should lead a global campaign to save mothers in childbirth. Right now, the amount we Americans spend on maternal health is equivalent to less than 1/20 of 1% of the amount we spend on our military. The World Health Organization estimates that 536,000 women perished in pregnancy or childbirth in 2005, a toll that has barely budged in 30 years. Child mortality has plunged, longevity has increased, but childbirth remains almost as deadly as ever, with one maternal death every minute. Some 99% of those deaths occur in poor countries. The most common measure is the maternal mortality ratio, MMR. This refers to the number of maternal deaths for every 100,000 live births, although the data collection is usually so poor that the figures are only rough estimates. In Ireland, the safest place in the world to give birth, the MMR is just 1 per 100,000 live births. In the United States, where many more women fall through the cracks, the MMR is 11. In contrast, the average MMR in South Asia, including India and Pakistan, is 490. In sub-Saharan Africa, it is 900. And Sierra Leone has the highest MMR in the world, at 2,100. While MMR measures the risk during a single pregnancy, women in poor countries undergo many pregnancies. So statisticians also calculate the lifetime risk of dying in childbirth. The highest lifetime risk in the world is in the West African country of Niger, where a girl or woman stands a 1 in 7 chance of dying in childbirth. Overall, in sub-Saharan Africa, the lifetime risk of dying in childbirth is 1 in 22. India disgraces itself, because for all of its shiny new high-rises, an Indian woman still has a 1 in 70 chance of dying in childbirth at some point in her life. In contrast, in the United States, the lifetime risk is 1 in 4,800. In Italy, it is 1 in 26,600. And in Ireland, a woman has only 1 chance in 47,600 of dying in childbirth. So lifetime risk of maternal death is 1,000 times higher in a poor country than in the West. That should be an international scandal. The gap, moreover, is getting wider. WHO found that between 1990 and 2005, developed and middle-income countries reduced maternal mortality significantly, but Africa reduced it hardly at all. Indeed, because of growing populations, the number of African women who died in childbirth rose from 205,000 in 1990 to 261,000 in 2005. Maternal morbidity, injuries in childbirth, occurs even more often than maternal mortality. For every woman who dies in childbirth, at least 10 suffer significant injuries such as fistulas or serious tearing. Unsafe abortions cause the deaths of 70,000 women annually and cause serious injuries to another 5 million. The economic cost of caring for those 5 million women is estimated to be $750 million annually. And there is evidence that when a woman dies in childbirth, her surviving children are much more likely to die young as well, because they no longer have a mother caring for them. Frankly, we hesitate to pile on the data, since even when numbers are persuasive, they are not galvanizing. A growing collection of psychological studies shows that statistics have a dulling effect, while it is individual stories that move people to act. In one experiment, research subjects were divided into several groups, and each person was asked to donate $5 to alleviate hunger abroad. One group was told the money would go to Rokia, a 7-year-old girl in Mali. Another group was told that the money would go to address malnutrition among 21 million Africans. The third group was told that the donations would go to Rokia, as in the first group, but this time her own hunger was presented as part of a background tapestry of global hunger, with some statistics thrown in. People were much more willing to donate to Rokia than to 21 million hungry people, and even a mention of the larger problem made people less inclined to help her. In another experiment, people were asked to donate to a $300,000 fund to fight cancer. One group was told that the money would be used to save the life of one child, while another group was told it would save the lives of 8 children. People contributed almost twice as much to save one child as to save 8. Social psychologists argue that all this reflects the way our consciences and ethical systems are based on individual stories and are distinct from the parts of our brains concerned with logic and rationality. Indeed, when subjects in experiments are first asked to solve math problems, thus putting in play the parts of the brain that govern logic, afterward, they are less generous to the needy. So we would prefer to move beyond statistics and focus on an individual. Simish Segeya. If more people could meet this warm 21-year-old peasant with a soft voice, we're sure maternal health would suddenly become a priority for them. Samish was lying on her back in a bed at the end of the main ward in the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital when we first saw her. Ruth Kennedy, the hospital's nurse midwife, translated as Samish told us how she had enjoyed an 8th-grade education, very impressive for rural Ethiopia. She had married at 19 and was thrilled when she became pregnant. Her girlfriends all congratulated her, and they all prayed that she would be blessed with a son. When she went into labor, no baby emerged. After 2 full days of obstructed labor, Samish was barely conscious. Her neighbors carried her for hours to the nearest road and put her on a bus when one finally arrived. The bus took another 2 days to get to the nearest hospital, and by then the baby was dead. When Samish began to recover back in the village, she found that she was crippled and leaking urine and feces. She was shattered and humiliated by the constant smell of her wastes. Her parents and husband saved $10 to pay a public bus to take her back to the hospital in the hope that her fistula could be repaired. When the bus came along, the other passengers took one whiff of her and complained vociferously, "We shouldn't have to ride next to somebody who stinks like that. We paid for this ride. You can't make us put up with that stink. Put her off. The bus driver returned Samisha's $10 and ordered her off the bus. Any prospect of a repair vanished. Samisha's husband then abandoned her. Her parents stood by her, but they built a separate hut for her because even they couldn't abide her odor. Every day they brought her food and water and tried to reassure her. Samish stayed in that hut, alone, ashamed, helpless. By one estimate, 90% of fistula patients have contemplated suicide, and Samish, too, decided she wanted to die. Depression swept over her, turning her numb and almost catatonic. People suffering from depression sometimes revert to the fetal position, and that's what Samish did, except that she almost never moved. I just curled up, she says, for 2 years. Once or twice a year, her parents took her out of the hut, but otherwise she just lay on the ground, hidden away, hoping that death would be her escape. She barely ate, because the more she ate or drank, the more wastes trickled down her legs, and so she began to starve to death. Samisha's parents loved their daughter, but they didn't know if doctors could help, and they had no money. She didn't ask for anything, barely spoke, just lay in her hut, wishing she were dead. After 2 excruciating years of watching their daughter suffer, her parents sold their livestock, all of their assets, to try to help Samish. It was clear that no bus would transport her, so they paid $250 for a private car to take them to a hospital in the city of Yurga Alem, a day's drive away. The doctors there found Samisha's case too complex and referred her to the Fistula Hospital. The doctors there reassured Samish, telling her that they could solve her problems, and she began to emerge from her depression. At first, she spoke only in furtive whispers, but slowly she began to re-engage with people around her. Before the doctors could try to repair the fistula, they had to address her other problems. After 2 years of constantly lying curled up in a fetal position, Samisha's legs had withered and become permanently bent. She couldn't move them, let alone straighten them, and she was too emaciated and weak to operate on. Catherine and the other doctors tried to strengthen Samish by giving her good food, and nurses were helping her with physical therapy so that she could straighten her legs. Then doctors found that 7 centimeters of her pubic joint had disappeared, apparently because of infection. The doctors performed a temporary colostomy, and after long and painful rounds of physical therapy, which Samish embraced as her depression faded, she was able to stand up again. Then she developed stress fractures in her feet, so the doctors prescribed intensive physiotherapy, and several former patients massaged her and worked with her, always careful to stop when the pain grew too agonizing. Finally, after months and months of grueling work, Samish was able to stretch her legs and stand. Eventually, she could even walk unassisted. Just as important, she had recovered her dignity and enthusiasm for life. Once she was strong again, the surgeons repaired her fistula, and she made a full recovery. Women like Samish have been abandoned by almost everyone in the world. But for decades, one American doctor has led the fight to call attention to maternal health. Even as he lost ground to a degenerative, lethal disease, he fought daily to lessen the toll of childbirth. A doctor who treats countries, not patients. Alan Rosenfeld grew up in the 1930s and 1940s in Brookline, Massachusetts, the son of a successful obstetrician in Boston. He went to medical school at Columbia and did a stint for the Air Force in South Korea. While in Korea, he volunteered on weekends at a local hospital and was shaken as he walked up and down the wards. Rural Korean women were suffering horrendous childbirth injuries unimaginable in the United States. Alan returned to America, but he was haunted by the memories of those stoic peasant women. The Korean experience left Alan with a deep interest in the medical needs of poor countries. When he later heard about a position at a medical school in Lagos, Nigeria, he signed up. In 1966, he took his new bride, Claire, to Lagos, where they started a new life together. Alan was bowled over by what he saw in Nigeria, particularly by the need for family planning and for maternal care. He also was beset by doubts. "I began to feel that the model of care we were giving wasn't appropriate for Nigeria," he recalled. That practical encounter with the realities of Africa was the beginning of a lifelong interest in public health, preventing disease rather than just treating patients as they turned up. In the West, we tend to think of disease and mortality as the province of doctors, but by far the greatest strides in global health have been made by public health specialists. Models of the public health approach include smallpox vaccination programs, oral rehydration therapy to save babies with diarrhea, and campaigns to encourage seatbelts and airbags in vehicles. Any serious effort to reduce maternal mortality likewise requires a public health perspective, reducing unwanted pregnancies and providing prenatal care so that last-minute medical crises are less frequent. Sometimes the most effective approaches aren't medical at all. For example, one out-of-the-box way to reduce pregnancies is to subsidize school uniforms for girls. That keeps them in school longer, which means that they delay marriage and pregnancy until they are better able to deliver babies. A South African study found that giving girls a $6 uniform every 18 months increased the chance that they would stay in school and consequently significantly reduced the number of pregnancies they experienced. Alan Rosenfield struggled to combine this public health perspective with practical medicine, and he became a social entrepreneur in the world of maternal health. Alan had intended for his service in Nigeria to be an interlude, his own version of the Peace Corps. But surrounded by such overwhelming needs, he began to feel a calling. He signed up for a job with the Population Council in Thailand. The Rosenfields spent 6 years there, starting a family, learning the Thai language, and utterly falling in love with the country. Yet the beauty of Thai beaches were a world apart from the horrors of the maternity wards. Moreover, IUDs and the pill were available only by prescription from a doctor, which meant that some of the most effective forms of contraception were unavailable to 99% of the population. So Alan worked with the Ministry of Health on a revolutionary scheme, allowing trained auxiliary midwives to prescribe the pill. First, he developed a checklist of questions so that a midwife could talk to a woman and either give her a prescription for the pill or, if there were risk factors, refer her to a doctor. Soon, the program was rolled out to 3,000 sites around the country. And eventually, the auxiliary midwives were authorized to insert IUDs as well. It's difficult to appreciate today how unusual this approach was, for physicians closely guarded their prerogatives, and it was heresy to entrust mere midwives with medical responsibilities. "Because it was so different an approach, I would have trouble getting it approved today," Alan said, "but because I was on my own, I could do it." The trajectory of his career was set. Public health work to make it safe for women to have babies. In 1975, Alan moved to New York to head the Center for Population and Family Health at Columbia University. He developed a global network of allies in the field, and in 1985, published a landmark article along with Deborah Main, a colleague, in The Lancet, the British journal that has been at the forefront of global health issues. It declared, "It is difficult to understand why maternal mortality receives so little serious attention from health professionals, policymakers, and politicians. The world's obstetricians are particularly neglectful of their duty in this regard. Instead of drawing attention to the problem and lobbying for major programs and changes in priorities, most obstetricians concentrate on subspecialties that put emphasis on high technology." The article led to a global advocacy movement on behalf of maternal health, and it coincided with the appointment of Alan as Dean of Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Then, in 1999, With a $50 million grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, he launched an organization called Averting Maternal Death and Disability, AMDD, which undertook a pioneering global effort to make childbirth safe. Increasingly, Allen began approaching maternal death not just as a public health concern, but also as a human rights issue. The technical solutions to reduce maternal mortality are not enough, Allen wrote in one essay. As a basic human right, women should be able to have a child safely and with good quality of care. The human rights system, laws, policies, and conventions must be used to hold states accountable for obligations undertaken pursuant to treaties. Allen was a trailblazer when he first headed abroad, but the field has caught up with him. In my day, we didn't even know what global health care was, he recalled. What I did was off the wall. But today, a lot of kids want to get into it. In medical schools today, global public health is a hot topic. And doctors like Paul Farmer of Harvard Medical School, who spends more time running hospitals in Haiti and Rwanda than in his office in Boston, are viewed by students as icons. Allen's own life took a tragic course in 2005. He was diagnosed with ALS and also myasthenia gravis, two diseases that affect motor nerves. He had always been athletic and outdoorsy, but now he found himself increasingly frail. He lost weight, had trouble walking and breathing, and then was consigned to a wheelchair. He worried about being a burden to his family. Yet he went to work every day and even attended international conferences. At the International Women's Health Coalition banquet in January 2008, he could barely move but was a center of attention, lionized by admirers from all over the world. In October 2008, he died. AMDD is now saving lives in 50 poor countries. We saw its impact when we stopped by a clinic in Zinder in eastern Niger, the country with the highest lifetime risk of maternal mortality in the world. Niger has only 10 OBGYNs in the entire country, and rural areas are lucky to have a physician of any kind in the vicinity. The Zinder clinic staff were startled and excited to see a couple of Americans, and they happily gave us a tour, even pointing out one heavily pregnant woman, Ramadou Issifou, who was lying on a stretcher, gasping and suffering convulsions. Between gasps, she complained that she was losing her vision. The sole doctor in the clinic was a Nigerian, Obendi Keodi, placed there as part of a Nigerian foreign aid program. If Nigeria can send doctors abroad as foreign aid, so can America. Dr. Keodi explained that Ramadou probably had eclampsia, a pregnancy complication that kills about 50,000 women a year in the developing world. So she needed a cesarean section. Once the baby was out, the convulsions would end as well. Ramadou was a mother of six, 37 years old, and her life was ebbing away in the little hospital waiting room. We're just calling for her husband, Dr. Keodi explained. When he provides the drugs and surgical materials, we can do the operation. The Zinder Clinic, it turned out, was part of a pilot program in Niger arranged by the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, and AMDD to fight maternal mortality. As a result, all the materials needed for a C-section were kept in sealed plastic bags and available if the family paid $42. That was a great improvement over the previous approach of having the families run all over town, spending far more to buy bandages here, gauze there, scalpels somewhere else. But what if Ramatou's family didn't have $42? In that case, she would probably die. If the family says they have no money, then you have a problem, Dr. Keodi explained. Sometimes you help, with the expectation that you will be paid back. At the beginning, I helped a lot, but then afterward, people didn't pay me back. He shrugged and added, "It depends on the mood. If the staff feel they can't pay out again, then you just wait and watch. And sometimes she dies." Still, the hospital staff didn't want Ramadou to die with us watching. The nurses wheeled her into the operating room and scrubbed her belly, and a nurse administered a spinal anesthetic. Ramadou lay on the gurney, breathing heavily and irregularly, otherwise motionless, apparently unconscious. Dr. Coyote came in, quickly sliced through Ramadou's abdomen, and held up a large organ that looked a bit like a basketball. That was her uterus. He carefully cut it open and pulled out a baby boy, whom he handed to a nurse. The baby was quiet, and it wasn't immediately clear if he was alive. Likewise, Ramadou was suspiciously comatose as Dr. K.